You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Thank you all for coming. We've had a change in the lineup. The House Energy and Commerce Committee is having a resolution, organizing resolution hearing tomorrow, and there's a staff briefing that's going on this afternoon. So our two staffers from the House Energy and Commerce Committee will not be able to join us this afternoon, but I'm sure that Aaron will do a good job in his place. Good afternoon. My name is Joe Keeley, and I'll be the moderator today. I'm an attorney at Aaron Fox, where I work in our government relations and IP groups. I was a former counsel at the Copyright Office and a copyright counsel to the House Judiciary Committee. Prior to that, I handled copyright policy issues at the Business Software Alliance. I'll now introduce our panelists. Aaron Cooper has joined us today from the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he handles a variety of intellectual property issues, including copyright issues. Prior to his time with Senator Leahy, Aaron was counsel to Senator Paul Sarbanes of Maryland and an associate at the law firm of Covington & Burling. We are also joined today by Alec French, a senior counsel in government relations with NBC Universal, where he handles copyright policy issues. Alec is a former staffer with the House Judiciary Committee under Howard Berman. Prior to his congressional service, Alec was counsel to a precursor of the Entertainment Software Association. Daryl Friedman is the Vice President for Advocacy and Government Relations of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. Daryl coordinates music industry outreach and lobbying, and one of NARIS's more visible roles is being the coordinator of the Grammys. Michael Petricrone, the Senior Vice President of Government Affairs for the Consumer Electronics Association, has been an active participant in the public policy debate regarding intellectual property laws and technology policy. Prior to his time with the association, Michael was in private practice. Finally, Gigi Sohn is the co-founder and CEO of Public Knowledge, where she has won numerous awards for her work in public policy. Prior to founding Public Knowledge in 2001, Gigi was the executive director of the Media Access Project. To kick off this panel, I'm going to first ask each panelist to list the issues that they expect Congress to act on or hold hearings on during the next 2 years. In the interest of time and turning to more detailed issues, I'm just going to ask each panelist if they could just give me a short bullet list of some of the issues they expect to come up. And why don't we just kind of go down the row here?
Thank you very much. I think there will be several, but in the interest of trying to keep it short, patent reform remains my boss's number one IP priority. It's not digital copyright, but that's his number one priority in the intellectual property realm. This is, as many of you know, a satellite home viewer reauthorization year. The Satellite Home Viewer Act, certain portions of it need to be reauthorized by the end of this year, and so that's something that I would expect that we will begin quickly, hold hearings on, and needs to be done by the end of the first session of Congress. Orphan Works legislation is something that's very important to my boss. It passed the Senate last year and got held up in the House, and we're hoping to complete that project this year. Performance rights is another high priority for Senator Leahy, and we look to be moving that this year as well. Those would be the top things that I think we can expect movement on in fairly short order this coming year.
Gigi?
Thanks, Joe, and it's great to see everybody here. Whoa. So I'm going to just twist your question a little bit and just talk about a little bit about my organization's priorities, and then after that I'll name the maybe one or two things that I think that Congress might act on. So I think the first priority for Public Knowledge is some significant copyright reform. I mean, without listing all the elements, people can go to our website. This is based on a speech I gave at Boston University last year. It's called 6 Steps to Copyright, Digital Copyright Sanity. And the idea is that the current copyright regime does not match the technological advances in our society and the way people actually use technology, and it's time to make it work. And some of the topics within that those 6 steps are...
Gigi, in the interest of time, can
okay.
we just get a very
okay,
brief
number one,
list
copyright
Congress.
Reform, okay? Number two, have to deal with policy laundering, specifically the anti-counterfeit trade agreement, which I won't explain what it is because Joe won't let me. And the third is, I would say, would come under the rubric of ISPs as copyright cops. And that's the effort to kick off alleged copyright offenders after 3 alleged violations, 3 strikes, what the content industry calls graduated response, and what I call shock and awe. And the effort to have ISPs automatically filter copyright.
Alec?
So back to the realm of things that might actually happen. A lot of feedback. Aaron covered a couple of the ones that are most obvious. I think another one that likely will come up is at some point the copyright office process on Section 108 will wrap up, and I assume there'll be some legislative recommendations coming out of that, so that's something that might happen or at least start moving on the Hill. Another one, and it's too bad Will and Neil aren't here, but there obviously has been a lot of net neutrality discussion, and depending on how that legislation would be shaped, it might have an impact on copyright protection, so that'd be another one I'd throw out there. And I'll leave some of the other obvious ones to you.
Yeah, well, the one that's been mentioned as the priority for Senator Leahy is also the priority for my organization. That's the performance rights legislation and a sound recording. It's a embarrassingly analog issue for a digital conference, but it makes sense to talk about in this context because it levels the playing field for internet radio and satellite radio, which pay the royalties that most of the world pays when compensating artists, my members, when their music is used on the radio. But the traditional broadcasters have had an exemption on this issue for as long as there's been radio. And both Congressman Connors and Senator Leahy, who chair the committees of judiciary of jurisdiction, have suggested that this will be an early topic, as will Orphan Works. And I think that's something that we're interested in exploring and making sure that there is access. At the same time, we want to make sure that only works that are truly orphan are used without compensation. So we just want to make sure our members are protected from that sort of usage.
Michael?
It's tough to be at the end of the line. I guess the one thing that I would add is in the last Congress, there was a lot of attention paid to the notion of statutory damages. As you know, unlike patent law, copyright law provides for extraordinarily large statutory damages for infringement without any or detached from any obligation to actually show actual harm. And there's a chilling effect on technology and a chilling effect on the development of new services. So what we would certainly like to see is a good hard look at statutory damages and reform so that litigation penalties, bear some logical relationship to the actual damages shown.
All right, thank you. I'm not sure the exact makeup of our audience, but I'm going to start with a very general question. Copyright has become a more active policy issue over the past two decades, but it seems as if we've come very quickly from the infamous "the internet is a series of tubes" comment by a certain senior senator to news stories about the future of the BlackBerry. As the Napster generation ages, those individuals are becoming legislative directors, chiefs of staff, committee counsel, judges, and even members of Congress. I'm curious to hear from the panel, what impact do you think a more tech-savvy generation will have on copyright policy debates, and have you seen any impact so far?
Well, I'll start on that. I think that one of the more important things that has happened as we become more mature in the digital age is things that, frankly, groups like or companies like Alex have been doing, which is to figure out a way to monetize their content on the web to blunt the impact of piracy. And I think that as we have a new generation of people in policy roles, I think that it's important to have the avenues out there for people to access the content that blunts the ability of the value of piracy. And I think that those types of business models that will continue to develop will help with the related policy issues.
Gigi, I know you take some issues that aren't always receive unanimous support, but when you go up to the Hill to lobby on various issues, do you find a more knowledgeable reception in members and their staff?
Well, there's definitely an age gap. There's no two ways about that. The younger staff understand, as I said before, that the current copyright regime and sort of the relentless march to stronger and longer copyright doesn't match what even they do in their own homes, and that the focus needs to be more on solutions for getting, people paid and less on, throwing people in jail and chopping off their toes for, uploading to a file-sharing network. I'm being a little bit glib, but the fact of the matter is that I think the younger staffers at least understand that it's about trying to pay the artists and trying to get the copyright owners paid as opposed to, continuing to lengthen and strengthen copyright.
Alec, I know when you and I were on the Hill together, there were some members in the Judiciary Committee that I wouldn't exactly call tech-savvy individuals. Have you seen a change as you've gone up to the Hill and lobbied on issues from an industry perspective?
I think, when I was there, and it's a bunch of years ago now, you didn't have many members using BlackBerrys. You didn't have many members logging on with email accounts. I think that's really changed. you see a large number of members now who are getting it and using technology in their own lives. Obviously, as Gigi said, it's true that at a, you know, at a younger staff level, there's much deeper penetration. I mean, I think that's a good thing in a number of ways. You know, on the one hand, you know, people understand, you know, how we are putting our content out in ways like Hulu or NBC.com or MSNBC.com. You can tell that story to people. They can go and they can find the stuff and understand that the perception created by some that our industries are dinosaurs that don't get it maybe doesn't match reality. We are out there trying to sell in new ways. You know, and also it makes it a little bit easier because they are tech savvy to talk to them about how technology can be used to help deal with some of the problems that technology is creating for us. So how some of the anti-piracy technologies out there, some of the things that we can do to try to protect our own content are, you know, actually things that could work and are working in the marketplace now. So, it, you know, they're evolving up there with the environment. We're evolving, and it makes it a little easier to talk about new ways to protect our content, new ways to distribute our content. All right.
Let me turn to some specific issues. Late last year, Congress enacted the Pro-IP Act. And as part of the act, Congress created the so-called IP czar. Who or what type of individual should be named to this position, and what should their agenda be for their first 100 days? Gigi?
I don't want to hog the conversation, but I think that person should come should not come from industry. It probably shouldn't come from an organization like mine. I'm certainly not putting my name.
Giving out a resume or something?
No, thank you. But I do think that person, and I think there's some agreement among my organization and others like the Copyright Alliance, that this is a person who should have a ministerial coordination role and should not have, should not make policy. And I think that would be very, very sound.
Anyone else care to add?
Yeah, I think that's going to be what it is. It's a coordinating role. So we sometimes overestimate what this is by the word czar, a term that I hate to always say that, you know, if it was really a copyright czar, then illegal file sharers would be lined up and shot as czars like to do. But this is going to be a coordinating role among among a number of entities, among, you know, from PTO to copyright.
I think Gigi would be leading the Rebel Alliance on that particular issue.
You know what? I don't have one piece of file sharing software.
Yeah, no, I know. But I think we agree on this point that it should, you know, it should be someone who is respected by both sides. You know, a name that was tossed out, and it's all fictional names, but Bill Ivey was a name that was tossed down. He's a guy who came, at one point, was involved in the music industry and has also been involved in very academic sort of writings about fair use. And he, not him maybe, but someone like that who can kind of see those sides of the debate would be the right kind of person, I think.
Michael?
Well, I'm not going to suggest any individuals, but just going back to the previous question. You know, we have a new administration, who came into office because of their power to use the internet to build online communities, because they recognize the power inherent in freeing information. And because they were able to figure out how to use the long tail to overcome existing incumbents. So, you know, you could actually say that the Obama campaign was kind of the best tech startup of 2008. So given that, I think the administration is going to be quite savvy to where the technology community is coming from, both, you know, in terms of general policy and with respect to this appointment.
I mean, I was just going to speak to, I think, what we, you know, we'd like to see someone there who really has the gravitas to go out and influence, you know, I mean, anyone who worked on the legislation or knows how it's crafted knows that, you know, this person doesn't have budgetary authority over any of the agencies, doesn't have, you know, any kind of primacy of role or even ability to set and determine policy for the agencies. This person has to be an ambassador somewhat and has to be someone with enough gravitas and enough support from the administration to be able to go out and really make sure the agencies are coordinating, are not duplicating, are achieving their mission and according, from our perspective, you know, IP protection, the stature it deserves as being one of the ways that our economy is frankly going to get out of the rut it's in. It's in highly skilled industries like the IP industries that bring in an enormous positive balance of trade, that generate, you know, jobs that on average pay about 40% more than the average job in the U.S., about $70,000 a year. I mean, if our economy is going to get out of this rut, we need to be focusing on how to help the creative industries play a part and remain strong and sound. And so this person needs to have enough gravitas that they play that role.
Aaron, obviously your committee is going to be the one overseeing the nomination debates, I guess you'd call it, to the extent there is a debate on a particular individual. What are your thoughts?
Well, I just want to add it. in general, no, I don't think anybody here would support inefficient enforcement of our intellectual property laws, right? And that nobody's going to support that. There might be disagreement down this table as to which laws should be enforced and how strongly and so forth. But the problem that we heard and the problem that led to from the Conyers and Smith offices, from the offices in the Senate side, to want to have this intellectual property enforcement coordinator was a problem of coordination both within agencies and among agencies. And that's the goal of the coordinator, is to make sure that there is not an inefficient mechanism for enforcing the intellectual property laws.
All right.
Joe, if I could just point out one thing. A lot's been said about the Obama administration as a very tech-savvy administration, which of course it is. What doesn't get said as often is he is also a copyright owner. He's a creator himself, an author, a Grammy winner, the first sitting president to be a Grammy winner, which means something to us. But I think that also will play into his mindset, not just the technology, but being an author and being an owner of copyright.
Thanks. Those two first questions, in all honesty, were a little, I'll call, warm and fuzzy, so I'm going to go ahead and throw some chum in the water here and see what kind of reaction I have here. All right, this is a two-part question. This Monday, the Supreme Court asked the Department of Justice to weigh in on whether it should hear the Cablevision case. Some media stories have referred to Cablevision as the next Sony Betamax or Grokster case. I've also heard about legislation to fix the Cablevision issue. Question one, is the Cablevision case really that important to copyright policy? Why and what outcome do you think is the appropriate outcome? And question two, there was significant debate over the Induce Act in 2004. For a while, it seemed as if there might be a new law, but the legislation went nowhere. In 2005, the Supreme Court issued its unanimous Grokster decision addressing similar issues to the Induce Act, and the legislation was never heard from again. Looking more broadly beyond Grokster and Cablevision, what should be the role for Congress in high-profile copyright cases such as these? Wait until there's a specific final decision by the courts, or speed up the process by legislating a specific outcome?
I'm curious what the industry
thinks. I'll take the first crack at it. I mean, first of all, you know, to us, this is a issue right now, obviously, in the courts. That's, you know, we think that the circuit court obviously came out wrong in the case, and we think it has really important public policy implications. Not to get into the nitty-gritty of the case, but, you know, kind of in all three areas where they ruled, whether a buffer copy is an actual reproduction that has copyright implications, the definition of a public performance, and then also the kind of related issue of who actually made the copies, Cablevision or the end user. In all three of those areas, we think the court came out wrong, and we think there are really major implications for that. Just to, again, not take too much time, but to go into one, I mean, the thought that Cablevision can set up servers that they control, they own, and have copies be made on those servers, but have essentially said, someone else push the copy button. You know, you push the copy button, it's on our servers, we set up the system that enables the copying, we set up the system that serves those copies to other people, but because we're saying you push the button, Cablevision hasn't actually made the copies, we think is wrong on the law, but just from implications, I mean, you know, it's kind of law school 101 to me that, you know, one of the first cases is the guy who sets up the gun that's pointed at the door that has the string that goes out of the trigger and to the door handle. The fact that someone opens the door and the gun goes off and kills them doesn't mean they committed suicide. They were murdered. They were murdered by the person who set up the gun.
I knew this would be chum. Just the perfect question.
and just to talk about the implication part of it, I mean, to us what this case means is it's basically setting a roadmap out for how anyone who wants to create a copyright infringing service can fully automate the process, create a system that infringes copyrights, but because they have outsourced the push the button service, push the button function, they escape copyright infringement liability. And to us, that has implications not just for our industry, this case only involves network DVRs and the television industry, but for music and software and everyone else.
Michael, I take it you have a slightly different perspective?
Yeah, just to clarify, first of all, these are not guns. Guns are very different, because secondary liability does not apply to gun manufacturers, only to our folks. So our things are a bit more dangerous. look, I mean, this is a common sense issue. We can sit here and debate it, but you know, it's perfectly legal to record for your own home use. Betamax says that. Most people sitting here probably do it every day. One of the wonderful things about tech is it is not location specific. So this is a situation where, you know, if you are recording for your own home use, and you're pushing the button, whether the box that you're using is sitting on top of the growing pile of boxes under your TV, or is located in another room. I mean, let's be practical here. It's immaterial. And to come out another way just you know, retards innovation for no apparent purpose. I think, and again, I'm coming from a specific viewpoint here, but I just find that very difficult to argue against. I can't imagine what the problem is and what Cablevision is doing.
Gigi, your thoughts?
So I agree with Michael. I mean, this is a TiVo. It's the same thing. And I thought that the lower court, which kind of looked under the hood of this service and said, no, it's less like a TiVo. It's more like on the video on demand. No, it's a TiVo, except the copy is residing somewhere else. So the consumer, all it does is benefit the consumer to the extent they don't have to buy a box. Okay, so, you know, to me, like Michael said, it's a pretty simple common sense issue. Second, I do think that it raises the Sony question, and whether Sony is still valid was squarely raised in this case. So I do think Sony is at risk. You know, and when I say Sony, I mean the doctrine that if a technology is capable of substantial non-infringing use, therefore it is legal. It's already been diluted by Grokster. We all know that. But I think even the underlying, you know, basic Sony doctrine that says that a technology manufacturer should not be liable for the bad deeds of the user, if their technology is capable of substantial non-infringing uses, I think that is at risk here. Third is, again, this gets back to the point that I will continuously make about the disconnect between current copyright law and our technological reality. Every time you bring up a document from your random access memory, you're making a copy. Okay, every single webcast necessitates a buffer copy, which is one of the court find it was like 1.4 seconds long and therefore was a fair use. I mean, are we really going to say that every single temporary or ephemeral copy now demands a licensing fee? I think that's completely insane. I really do. And do we really want the mess, if this case is reversed, do we really want the mess that's going to ensue in the music world and in the video world if the court is to say that, well, you know, a buffer copy is a copy and therefore it demands a licensing fee? I don't want to see that world.
Aaron, are you hearing anything from industry or local groups?
I think I just heard things on both sides.
I'm sure you did, but folks coming in looking for something right away?
The only sort of peacemaking I would try to make is, I believe, at least on the direct infringement point, I believe the challenge is just on direct infringement, that it doesn't apply to contributory secondary liability, and I think that in certain ways that limits the implication of it.
My second part of the question was whether you think Congress should step in before the Supreme Court, assuming the Supreme Court takes the case, or it may not, but should Congress be stepping in this issue now? Should it just wait to see what happens? I'm just curious, show of hands, to think that Congress should step in. Does anyone think that Congress should introduce legislation or hold hearings or anything like that? Or more wait for the courts to decide? Seems like it's a wait-and-see attitude.
Let me just say, there are going to be a lot of television-related, copyright television-related sure. issues coming up in the next year as we do Satellite Home Viewer Act. And, I assume Gigi and others will tell me, will tell Congress why it is that, that there's no need to get involved, at least if the way things are sitting now. And on the other side, I think there's concern.
I've never known Gigi to be shy, so I don't think you have to worry about that.
I just think if Congress acts, particularly now, it's picking winners and losers in the marketplace. And I don't think Congress should do that. It's saying TiVo, and, you know, I love TiVo. We work very closely with them on a number of issues. But saying TiVo, you win, ISPs, you lose. So I would be very much against that.
I like real brief.
Just to respond, I mean, I think Aaron's point is critical. This wasn't a case about the gun manufacturer. This is the case about who pulled the trigger. And just to respond, I mean, that gets to a very important point that both, I think, Michael and Gigi are missing. This isn't suing people for a technology. This is suing them for a service they're operating on an ongoing basis, making and maintaining copies, delivering them to people. This isn't a VCR that goes out in the marketplace, stream of commerce, anyone can do what they want with it. Cablevision maintains control over this service and whether copies are made and how they're made and who they're delivered to on a day-to-day basis. So it is about a service, which is nothing that the Betamax decision touched on. It's not about a device in the marketplace.
If I could just ratchet down the rhetoric here. I mean, this isn't about guns. This is about people who are recording The Daily Show so they could watch it after their kids go to bed in their house, which is legal and should continue to be legal. I just want to reaffirm Gigi's point, which is just demonstrates how far copyright law has gotten from the practical reality of what people do, including most of the people in this room, on a daily basis. I mean, this is ridiculous.
All right, let's move on to the next topic. Webcasting seems to be the industry that generates vastly more excitement than revenues. It has also generated lots of legislation. Although webcasting is a copyright issue, it's also a dollars issue. Copyright owners and webcasters simply can't agree on an appropriate rate. It seemed that the creation of a copyright royalty board would remove the financial issues from Congress, and for a while it actually did. With some now unhappy with the board's webcasting royalty decision, the issue has now popped back up. What should happen in this particular situation? Should Congress get involved, not get involved? And what is the proper role for Congress in any kind of financial debate like this? Aaron, since you're the first and only congressional representative, I'll turn to you, and then I'll ask the other folks in the panel.
The issue of music royalties generally, whether we're talking about through satellite radio, whether we're talking about webcasting, whether we're talking about over-the-air broadcasting, is one that's going to be it's going to be debated this year. And from Senator Brownback and Senator Wyden on the webcasting side, and the Senate who have legislation about that, to Senator Leahy's top priority about performance rights for broadcasting over the air, to Senator Feinstein's concern about parity. I think those are issues that were going to play out this year. There was the concern that the sky was going to fall last July 15th. Didn't fall, but we're still in a murky area, and I think that those are all issues that are going to be discussed as we figure out how to make sure that artists are fairly compensated for their work.
Daryl, you have something to add?
Well, this goes back to your issue about staffers and sort of their use of technology. This was one where clearly, I mean, staffers were listening to webcasts and were getting the message through the webcasters like Pandora that this was going to, they were going to shut their doors, that these rates were too high and Pandora was going to go out of business. In fact, we're coming up on the 2-year anniversary of Pandora's about to go out of business, as the other webcasters as well. This is a case about, to answer your direct question, what should Congress do? I think exactly what they did. They gave us more time. Now, I should disclose when I say us, I'm also on the board of Sound Exchange, which is the collective that collects the money from webcasters and pays artists. Mr. Berman and others in Congress gave us more time to come to some settlement, some marketplace settlement, which I think can still happen. We have another 4 or 5 weeks. But the issue here really is about a technology that's not monetizing. And webcasting, if you look at satellite radio, if you look at the revenue they get from subscriptions, if you look at traditional broadcast radio, the revenue they get from advertising, webcasting is just simply not finding a way to monetize, and they've said to us, well, since we can't raise this money, you should take less. You know, the restaurant across the street from me went out of business, but they didn't have a chance to tell the food suppliers, well, just don't charge me as much for the chicken, that way I can stay in business. That's what the webcasters have said to us, the artists, my members. You just take less. So I think the CRB ruled correctly. I think Congress did exactly what it should do, which is just give us the opportunity to negotiate and not try to legislate a rate, which is what the webcasters asked for. And remember, the webcasters wanted the system. The system that we have, the CRB system, was the one that the webcasters asked for and got. They just didn't like the result.
I've got the solution, and it's in our 6 points. So first of all, Congress should require broadcasters to pay the public performance fee that they're exempt from, but that everybody has to pay. Okay, that's the fee that goes to the copyright holder and to the artist. Need to level the playing field. And that sort of brings us to the reality that that is how artists are more and more getting paid these days, or by performance and less by, you know, hard physical copy. At that point, they should, across the board, for all the services, including website, webcasting, 2-3% of revenues. Okay, so make the broadcasters pay, and that will bring an enormous amount of money, and then lower the rate for everybody, similarly, to about 2-3% of revenues, and everybody will be very rich and very happy, and webcasters will be able to survive.
So, Gigi, can I ask you, if a webcaster is making no money, then the artist should make no money, even though their work is being used? You're basing it totally on the percentage of revenue.
That's correct.
Well, you've both led to my next question, which is about performance royalty legislation. Last year, dueling legislation was introduced with a huge difference in sponsorship. In the House, 227 members sponsored legislation to oppose what they viewed as a tax on broadcasters, while only 20 members sponsored legislation to support what they viewed as a basic fairness principle and an aligning of U.S. laws with international norms. How do you see the issue playing out in this Congress and, quite frankly, in this economy? Is this debate simply a Full Employment Act for lobbyists, or is there a real chance for change in the status quo? Or perhaps should this issue be resolved by the Copyright Royalty Board, which, depending on your perspective, may be a good thing or bad thing?
Well, just to correct, when you say there was legislation on one side and there's legislation on the other side, there was, in fact, a non-binding resolution on one side. There's a lot of sponsors who signed on as a favor because it's easy to sign a non-binding resolution. And then there was real copyright legislation sponsored by the people with jurisdiction, Senator Leahy, Congressman Conyers, Congressman Coble, people whose staffers are in this room, people who have jurisdiction over this issue, very serious about correcting an 80-year-old injustice, which is basically the broadcasters have had an exemption that no one can justify. So we believe that this is going to be an issue that's going to move fairly quickly. And in terms of the economy, I think that does play in our favor, because this bill would unlock tens of millions of dollars of foreign money that's collected for American artists, but not paid to American artists because we don't have reciprocity. So we have a situation where our economy is going in a very bad situation, metaphors I could come up with, but you all use them. And here we have money in foreign countries sitting there for our economy, for the trade balance certainly works in our direction, and we can't unlock it because we don't have this legislation. So the economy is something that should be more motivation to get this passed ASAP.
Anyone else? Michael?
Well, just to get back to what Gigi said, you would think we don't have a stake in this fight. But having just gotten back from a little show called CES, one of the things that we noticed, was fascinating, is that Pandora and these streaming services are now being built into a wide variety of products, which is very, very exciting. So, you know, I would just say, so we have an interest in those services, in Pandora and other similar services surviving and thriving. So I guess my suggestion to my colleagues on the right are, you know, we all know that physical sales are going away. That's the trend. It's undeniable. And we all know the future is in the services. And it's not about control. It's about compensation. So I would just urge them to be patient, because a lot of these services right now they're new, they're nascent, they're not bringing in a lot of money. But they will be, if allowed to thrive, be the future of their industry, and our industry too, we hope. So, you know, if we could just hold off and not cook the golden goose right now and be patient, as far as what kind of royalties we're looking for, I think in the end, in the medium term and the long term, we'll all be much, much better off.
Now, a few of you have mentioned satellite reauthorization. This might be an issue that pops up, or some of these issues pop up in that context, but that's clearly a major legislative issue that comes up every 5 years, including this one. It's definitely a full employment act for lobbyists and with the ability to impact your revenue streams. What issues do you see coming up in the satellite reauthorization process this year? Which of these issues are new, and which of these are perennial issues? And has the lobbying already begun? Aaron, I'll turn to you for this one.
Well,
I'll look into your calendar here to see who's coming to visit you.
I think we're still very early in the process to know exactly what different groups with an interest in the legislation are going to be supporting. I think that there are two things that most people agree need to be done. The statutory licenses need to be modernized, because we don't know exactly what date right now, but the digital transition will happen sometime this year. And the both the satellite and, to a lesser extent, the cable licenses are geared towards an analog world. They're all about analog broadcasts and when you switch to digital and so on, and that needs to be modernized. I think everybody who has looked at or had the pleasure of reading any of the copyright statutory licenses for television, it will either put you to sleep or it will make your eyes cross. And there's a need to simplify the licenses. And I think those are two things that will be key components of the legislation this year.
Alec, I take it you have a more than passing interest in the legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to use the legislation to talk about a broader point. But, I mean, you know, this is, for people who don't know, the reauthorization of a compulsory license that tells copyright owners, you don't get to charge a market rate for the use of your work. You have to go and accept the rate set by the CRB. Now, you know, we have a big problem with that, being told your property isn't stuff you can market freely in the marketplace, get the best rate you can. You've got to go to this panel and have them set it for you. Now, the interesting thing about the satellite license, and it bespeaks the webcasting issue, is, of course, with the satellite license, that's how it started. But in 1998, the then CARP set the rate at a market rate. The satellite guys went ballistic, and the statute ever since then has said, whatever the market rate is, the stuff that what the satellite guys will pay will be 40% less than that. The webcasting scenario is the same thing. CARP sets the rate, or CRB in this case. Political pressure is brought to bear, and the rate is dropped below even what a government panel would set, which, you know, we can all argue about whether it was even close to the market rate. This is the problem with compulsory licenses. One, they're subject to political interference by the users who just generate pressure and get the rates lowered below a fair market rate. The second thing I'd like to point out is, hallelujah, and this is great, we just got paid under the satellite license. I just got a disbursement, and thank you very much to the Copyright Office for doing it. The disbursement we got was for the fees paid for television broadcasts from 1998 to 2003. Well, 6 years later, what about 2004 or 5? That hasn't happened yet. They're very inefficient processes that do not compensate copyright owners correctly at market rates, and it's not money that, you know, we get. We're not getting as much and as quickly as we would if we were out there licensing it in the market, and maybe if we were out there licensing in the market, we'd see a little more innovation in the markets and, in fact, more willing to cooperate with the services in a market-based way.
Gigi?
So I think I tend to, I go back and forth, but I think I tend to agree with Alec for the most part that compulsory licenses are not the answer and they're too capable of being prejudiced by one side or the other. That being said, I think we have to be really careful about tossing, when we're talking about broadcasting and cable casting and satellite broadcasting, talking about the marketplace, okay, because the marketplace doesn't really operate here. Right? Broadcasters have must-carry rights. That's not the market. That's the government giving you huge benefits, mandatory carriage or retransmission consent, the right to basically, you know, ask a cable operator to carry MSNBC and CNBC and all your other, you know, cable stations if they carry your broadcast station. So you gain tremendous benefits. You get distant signal prohibition. So in other words, you know, a cable operator in D.C., if I want to watch my Mets, I can't watch my Mets, on my cable operator because it's banned. You can't import distant signals. So I think we just have to be careful when we talk about marketplace transactions and broadcasting because the broadcast industry gets so much protection from the government. The whole public interest standard is a protection. You know, you have exclusive licenses to do essentially whatever you want. So let's be careful, despite the fact that I probably agree with you on compulsory licenses, we're not talking about a real marketplace operating here.
Daryl, your industry lives in many ways in a compulsory license world. What are your thoughts, your industry's thoughts on compulsory licenses?
Well,
overall,
they're
positive, or negative?
They're good and bad. I mean, we don't like the concept of compulsory license because generally it lowers the value of copyright, and my members who create the music would like to have two things. One, the maximum compensation for their music, and two, some control over how it's used and the ability to say no, which a compulsory license takes from you. On the other hand, you know, you have compulsory license when there's market failure. In the case of the webcasting, for example, imagine if, or broadcasters, imagine if any radio broadcaster had to actually license every sound recording that they wanted to use and, you know, and have to go and do deals, and it's just sort of, it would be impossible to play anything on the station. So you have a compulsory license, they pay the fee, they can play anything, and there's a benefit to, I think, both sides in having that in certain situations where the market really can't capture everything.
The compulsory license issue came up, and has continued to come up in music licensing issues, not royalty issues, but music licensing issues. And a few years ago, there was legislation dealing with music licensing, specifically the Section 115 compulsory license. And there's been some discussion about whether there's a need for continuing legislation in that area, and I'm curious what your thoughts are in that particular space, not the royalty space, but how the music system is set up and what licenses are needed.
And it should be mentioned that Joe lost many nights' sleep as a staffer working on that very issue.
I had the pleasure, and I put that word in ironic quotes, to deal with that.
Much of what we were trying to address in that legislation, the Section 115 legislation, actually some of it, not all of it, but some of it was addressed in the CRB ruling and some in private negotiations. I should note that the music industry, which is a dysfunctional family, has gotten a little bit of its act together, and twice a year we convene the heads of all the trade associations, from the labels to the publishers to the artists to the songwriter. And one of the outcomes of that was an agreement to sort of go to the CRB and say, hey, you know, we'll put into place some of these things, especially for the interactive streaming rate, which we want a business that we really want to get off the ground. We'll put into some, some agreement on this compulsory license on 115. So I don't know that there's as much of a fire for legislation on this issue because of the CRB ruling, but there are certain things that are still out there. It would be great to have this sort of super agency that can collect for all the publishing works, and that's a problem in our industry. If you ask anybody who's involved in transactions in music, either on the digital side or on the content side, it's hard to cut these deals because of all the different publishing agencies that are out there. So one of the aspects that's still on the table, which would be ripe for legislation, would be sort of a designated agent to cover these issues.
Now, Michael, I would imagine that when you hear that the music industry is getting together and coming to some kind of agreement, it probably makes you kind of nervous about what they're coming up with. What are your thoughts about music licensing reform and the need for legislation in that area?
I think we'll see. Again, it's as far as them coming together, that's between them and their antitrust counsel, I guess. But but yeah, the CRB has largely handled this issue.
Fair enough. I'm going to ask one more question. Actually, two more questions, then we'll, at the end, open to audience questions. Two words, network neutrality. Now, just mentioning these words generates a physical response among those who hear them. To some, it's like discussing Social Security reform in an AARP convention. And to others, it's like discussing the availability of federal bailout money at a domestic automobile manufacturers conference. But from a purely copyright perspective, network neutrality has included debate on the ability of network providers to filter unauthorized copyrighted content. Is the ability or even need to filter unauthorized content a red herring in the network neutrality debate, or is it a legitimate issue?
I'm going to take advantage of the fact that the two people who are going to be here from the House Commerce Committee aren't here to say this is completely a Judiciary Committee issue. obviously, there are sides of it that are regulatory, there are sides of it that are competition-based, and there are sides of it that have to do with what you pose about making sure that we're only talking about not blocking lawful content. And the question is, how do we do it? And I think that part of it is something that will be more discussions over the next 2 years, to try to figure out what it is that we can do to limit the amount of piracy on the web, but not step over the line where we get into having ISPs be the one who are deciding what's lawful and what's not lawful. So I think that is going to be an ongoing debate in this Congress, and I think we've heard from some of the commerce folks that they plan on taking a look at it, not because of the copyright side, but just purely on the net neutrality side.
I'll turn to Alec and then Gigi for their comments.
Well, this is an area where, again, we think that technology, if allowed to innovate, can come up with a lot of the solutions to the piracy problems that use of some technology creates for us. And, on these issues, again, there are exciting anti-piracy technologies, fingerprinting technologies, graduated response, blocking technologies that can be used with incredible exactness to filter out copyright infringing content while letting through stuff that would be the stuff that Gigi champions, fair use, mashups, that kind of thing. These technologies are implemented with, again, great, great effect on all the UGC sites you go to, YouTube, Dailymotion, Soapbox, all the US UGC sites, after an agreement they came to with us copyright owners, have implemented filtering. Try not to waste too much time, but the quick example, the Sarah Palin skits, that Tina Fey did for SNL, are not on YouTube. They weren't on YouTube. They're not on the other UGC sites because they got filtered out using filtering technology. But actually, if you go on there, on YouTube, etc., you'll find clips. In fact, what you'll find, which is pretty ingenious, I admit, is you can find almost the entire skit, but cut and pasted together from various news broadcasts where they use parts of the skits. People went to the effort of taking from CBS in Raleigh, the first 15 seconds because it appeared there, and then WRC, our local station here, the other 15 seconds, they put it all together. You can actually tell because you can see the news icons in the corners as the thing goes. That wasn't filtered out, okay, because it wasn't an exact match to the actual content that we own. So the point is, these technologies are very exciting. Our concern is, and this is the other side of stifling innovation, our concern is if ISPs are given the message by Congress that basically you have to steer clear, you have liability of some sort for experimenting with any technology that might effectively deal with the copyright infringement problems, with filtering out illegal copyright infringing material, you kill the marketplace for the technology companies that want to go into this space. You kill the demand for it because ISPs say, whoa, we don't want to touch this. We're going to end up being hauled before the FCC or Congress. So this is a technology marketplace that very much needs to be given the incentive to innovate. And if net neutrality legislation doesn't clearly delineate that it's not stopping these type of activities, it will kill innovation in that marketplace.
So what UGC sites do is completely irrelevant to the net neutrality debate, okay? Because net neutrality is about the companies that provide the on-ramps to the internet, and in this country it's 98% cable and telephone, okay? Whether they pick winners or losers, whether they, you know, give priority to certain content, you know, folks that pay them, or degrade others, or block others. So it has nothing to do, you know, what Google is doing and all that. It's all well and good. Don't have a problem with it generally. And I think Google's done actually a very good job of being sensitive to some of the issues. But that's really irrelevant. Okay, I'll say right here and now that automatic filtering and shock and awe, that's a violation of net neutrality, plain and simple. But that gives you an awful lot of room within the net neutrality rubric to enforce your copyright rights. It doesn't prohibit, you know, law enforcement from enforcing copyright. It doesn't prevent the DMCA from being used. It doesn't prevent a whole lot of copyright enforcement, but it does prevent the automatic filtering. And, you know, the problem with automatic filtering is it may be really good, it may be correct 97% of the time, but for that 3% of the time that it's wrong, that it misses a fair use, that it blocks a John McCain video, we're talking about speech, we're talking about, you know, speech that could affect the political process or something else that's really critical, you know, to life and liberty and the pursuit of, you know, happiness. So you can't really mess around. Just because filters may be very accurate, the times they're not accurate could be very dangerous. So I do think automatic filtering really is problematic, and shock and awe or three strikes is very, very problematic as well as far as net neutrality is concerned. That being said, I continue to urge the content companies and the broadcasters to be pro-net neutrality, because I think you've got a lot more to lose if the cable and telephone providers pick you as the loser than you do with any copyright issue. Okay? If you're not, you know, if you're not getting equal treatment on the broadband pipe, if you're, you know, if the NBC Universal website just doesn't come up fast enough so somebody's going to go to CBS or ABC, you're screwed. So I told broadcasters, I spoke at the Consumer Electronics Show last week, and I was on a panel with David Rear, who's the head of the National Association of Broadcasters. He didn't quite get it. And I said, David, I'll tell you what it is in broadcaster terms. It's a must carry for the 21st century, and you should be for it. And Alec, NBC Universal almost was for it a couple of years ago, and I urge you to be for it, and I don't think it will prevent you from enforcing your copyright rights.
Daryl, I've heard some songwriters in particular have talked about network neutrality and, you know, need to prevent piracy. Where does the music industry stand on network neutrality, and where are the divides, if there are any divides?
Yeah, well, just to clarify, music industry, I'm only speaking for my constituents, which are the artists, songwriters, and record producers. And I hear both sides of this. What Gigi just said, I hear from my members, and what Alex said, I hear from my members. Here's the issue. Content creators certainly want their works protected, and there's a concern that net neutrality will prevent that from happening, from protection, as Alex spoke. There's also the exact opposite concern of the winner-loser situation that Gigi just mentioned. If you're on an independent label, does that mean that you're going to get a slower download than a major label would get? Those kinds of concerns I hear from artists, too. So I think what will come down is that we'll be in favor of the concept in general as long as there are some legitimate protections. You know, we don't want net neutrality to mean piracy is equal to legitimate commerce. If that's the definition of neutrality, that's not good for our guys. But there is a middle ground on this that I think we would be in favor of.
Michael?
Right. On net neutrality, you know, we are a broad and varied association, and we pretty much come down along where the FCC principles are. We are nervous about filtering because the issue is overbreadth. Alex says that filters are making progress. Show me a filter that can determine when something's being used for commentary. Show me a filter that can determine what parody is. Like, sometimes I don't even know what parody is. So we think is troublesome. For all these issues, the key is to protect your IP, which is important. We're also an IP business, while doing minimal collateral damage to lawful consumers. And the way you do that, I think, is by empowering people. This cross-cuts along all the issues. I didn't go on YouTube or the pirate sites to see the Sarah Palin, the amazing Sarah Palin skits that I missed. And the reason I didn't was because I went on Saturday Night Live's website on NBC, and I saw them, and as did millions of other Americans. And there was just a huge paradigm shift. From a few years ago, there was a skit, a hilarious skit on Saturday Night Live that I'll refer to as Thing in a Box. And that was up on a few sites. And NBC went to extraordinary measures to send letters and pull it down and made it very, very difficult to see. People saw it anyway, but it was tough. And with the Sarah Palin thing, with Tina Fey, they had the exact same phenomenon. And they decided to make it as easy as possible for people to see. As I recall, you could even download it. So I think that's, hopefully, on this issue and across the board, this is where the industries are going. And they realize that if you give up some control and you empower consumers, in the end, that is going to rebound to your benefit.
Quick rejoinder, I'm happy to show you those technologies. Actually, one of them demoed last night at the tech demo that this conference is part of, Vobile Technologies. I challenge you to find fair uses that they're restricting on any of the UGC sites. And lastly, technically, if you put any commentary in with one of our movies and then tried to ship it across the internet, that would change the hash value and the filter would not stop it. So it is an exact match. The technology is that good, and the fact that some may say the technology isn't there today, it's just very curious for a representative of the technology industry to say technology won't evolve from today to tomorrow when it comes to IP protection, whereas when it comes to great new services for consumers, of course it'll evolve.
All right, final question. Assume for a moment I've been given a magic wand. With my new power, I end the drawn-out patent debate that seems to go on forever and the need to confirm various judges and DOJ nominees. This will free up lots of time for members to spend on other copyright issues, perhaps, and perhaps ones that are less visible than the ones we've spoken about today. What would you want members of Congress to either hold hearings on, introduce legislation on those issues, besides the ones we've talked about today? So not performance rights issues, network neutrality, satellite reauthorization. Are there any other issues that we really haven't gone into detail today that you think are important enough that Congress needs to take a look at over the next 2 years? And maybe you already know of some that we're going to take a look at.
I mean, Orphan Works, absolutely. Aaron and his colleagues did a fabulous job in the Senate. I wish we could have gone there in the House. And I do think we also have to look at statutory damages. I completely agree with Michael in that regard. And the third thing is I think we need to start to look at the issue of copyright abuse. You know, the hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of, DMCA takedown notices, many of them, just completely harassing, and see if we could sort of raise the standard so those kind of harassing notices and false notices aren't so common.
Anyone else? Aaron, I think you have some free time.
I just want to say that for the patent reform, you're not going to need a magic wand.
All right, we've come to the end of our panel. We have microphones here. Because this session is being recorded, I'm going to ask you actually to line up with the microphone so it can be recorded. If you stand up, they won't get the question on tape. And I'll ask anyone who has a question for the panelists to come forward. Just use the front microphone. It might be easier. If you could introduce yourself, name, and organization, then go ahead and ask your question.
Michael Nelson with the Communications, Culture, and Technology Program at Georgetown. Many of us were in a session before this one on the implications of cloud computing. And we had a little bit of discussion there about what I like to call CSP liability, cloud services providers liability. You've touched on a little bit of the issue when you've talked about Cablevision. But in 5 years, most of us will be doing most of our computing in the cloud. We'll be storing our data there. We'll be processing things. We'll be remixing things, not on our own laptop, but in the cloud. The Cablevision case gives us a hint of what some of the arguments are going to be about whether these providers of such services are going to be liable for copyright, piracy, and all the like. But I'd just like to get a sense from the panel of what principles should apply when we move to this new world, and it is happening. It's a major shift. It's a great new opportunity. But if we don't handle this right, we're gonna close it down before it ever gets started. So I'm just curious, what principles apply when somebody else is providing the platform that I'm using for all of my computing, whether it's storage, entertainment, processing, and the like?
I'd like to take a stab at that one.
That's a tough question without a specific example. I guess, and I don't even know if this qualifies, but one issue that our company has. It may be the same thing. Cyber lockers, is that kind of a version
of that? Another example is virtual worlds, where I'm storing all sorts of images in about my avatar and my fantasy world and somebody else's server, and I might want to upload copyrighted content for my personal use to share with my three friends in my virtual living room.
I mean, it's a very different issue than we've been talking about here, but it's one that's going to be real, and one and we can't say that I can't have fair use in my virtual living room. On the other hand, I take your point that I can't open up a virtual movie theater and start charging people $5 to see somebody else's content.
Yeah, the only one we kind of looked into at all is the cyber locker issue, which I guess you're saying is similar or related. And, you know, obviously, yes, we do have concerns with the idea that someone now, you know, is going to be putting our movies somewhere on a remote server, hosted in a cyber locker. You know, our general approach, of course, is going to be, you know, a company. There are things a company could do. I mean, I'm just, and again, this is not something talked within our company, so I'll disclaim any liability for my company on this. But, you know, we were talking about filtering technologies. Well, a cyber locker service, if they used Vobile's technology, just like UGC sites do, could scan the uploads that people are trying to make into the cyber locker to see if they match in the database to one of the works that are protected, ours, and disallow the individual from doing that if, in fact, it matches and it's an infringing work. If it didn't match, if it's not an exact hash value, it could get in. But the point is that when people are building out these services and know that there are copyright infringement liability issues with the service they're building out, they should look at technical ways to address their potential liability, perhaps by using something like the filtering technology.
Another example of a service that you could see provided in the cloud is my CD backup service. Or, you know, I've actually paid for CDs. I want to have them stored in the cloud so that I can have access wherever I go. I paid for it. Your filter would block me from uploading it, but I paid for it. It's my bits.
Aaron?
What principle should apply in that kind of case?
This is always a problem in technology law, right? That technology advances faster than the law can possibly do it. And one of the
Well, unless the law gets in the way of the technology.
Well, one of the tasks that we have is to draft legislation in a way that's sufficiently flexible, knowing that you're going to have a substantive change in these various different sections of the Copyright Act every 5, 10, 15 years. And it needs to be sufficiently nimble so that courts can wrestle with issues like they are wrestling with in Cablevision. And it needs to be sufficiently flexible. I'm not trying to prejudge how that should or shouldn't come out, but the idea that the law can adapt to, the law is written in a way that it can be adapted to changes in technology until, frankly, Congress is able to legislate again in that area. But I don't think the principles change. I think the principle is that intellectual property rights should be respected, and artists and the rights holders should be compensated, but it shouldn't be done in a system that inhibits innovation. I think those principles remain regardless of where the storage is taking place and advances in technology.
I'm going to turn to Gigi, and I'll ask if anyone else has any questions. Thank you.
So I think there's two ways to do it, one shorter term, one longer term. The shorter term way is just to say non-commercial personal uses are fair use and expand and clarify fair use. That's one way of doing it. The second way is to blow up the whole Copyright Act and get rid of the notion that a copy induces liability. I mean, it just, in my opinion, and it's just Pam Samuelson at Berkeley is actually working with a working group to try to completely rewrite copyright law, which is something I just don't have the time to do because I'm too busy speaking on panels like this. But, in our digital world, the notion that every copy causes liability just doesn't make sense.
All right, any other questions?
Hi. Tom Sidner, Progress and Freedom Foundation. I got a question for Gigi, I guess. Now, I'm a bit confused. In the Grokster case, public knowledge took a very aggressive interpretation of what the standard for secondary liability for a device distributor should be. And it's basically, its view was, it should be okay if your device is used for infringing purposes 97% of the time today, so long as someday it might be used for infringing purposes only 90% of the time. So in that context, you're willing to tolerate an extraordinary degree of what we guess could call imperfection of a technology that allows things to go on that the law does not permit. Then when we turn around, we're talking a few moments ago about a filtering technology, and you happen to pick the same number that was at issue in Grokster, 97, and said, well, even if it works 97% of the time, and only does what it's supposed to 97% of the time, that's not good enough. And don't we need to measure the standards of technical imperfection that we'll tolerate in a way that is consistent, depending on whether the technology at issue promotes copyright enforcement or copyright infringement?
Tom, Tom, I really do think that you completely misstated what was in that brief. And quite honestly, I don't remember exactly what was written 4 years ago, but I can't imagine we said that. I think what we said was we tried. Let's not have an argument. I'm really not interested, okay? But here's the larger, you could send me, I'm sure you will email me, the section of my brief where we said that. But that's beside the point, okay? In the case of the copyright filter, you're blocking legitimate protected speech, okay? That's not the case, even assuming arguendo that our brief said what it said, and I have no recollection of it saying that, and I seriously doubt. I think what we were doing was saying that the Sony standard was good and solid, and that doesn't say anything about 97%. That says about a technology that's capable of substantial non-infringing uses. But there's a speech aspect to what I'm concerned about, and there's not a speech aspect to what you're concerned about.
That's simply not true. You're deriving the notion that there is a speech, is there a protected speech aspect to fair use, which I agree there is, by the way, from the Eldred case.
And so does the Supreme Court.
Which states that. Supreme Court also says there is a greater First Amendment value in copyright protection. So we're talking about balancing.
I want to avoid a one-on-one debate here, so we have a question.
I don't want to debate, and I'd love to see where the Supreme Court said that about copyright.
Can I jump into your
discussion?
Sure, go
ahead. Go ahead, others.
Then we'll turn to Alec. The other interest at play is the interest in innovation, allowing innovation to go forward. And I think that the Betamax decision is a practical recognition of the fact that new technologies are often kind of delinquents. You know, they haven't quite grown up yet, and you know, sometimes they can do things they shouldn't. But then they do grow up. They do grow up and become, you know, substantial contributing members to society. Like with the Betamax, when the initial fear of the movie industry was all about the record button. And it turned out the record button wasn't that important. What people were really interested in was the play button. But, you know, had we not gotten to that point, had it not evolved to that point, had the consumer behavior not been allowed to evolve, think of all the industries that we would have missed. So, you know, because of that, the rather high bar that Betamax sets, you know, from an innovation standpoint, not wanting to choke off innovation, I think is appropriate.
Alec?
Just two quick points. One, to Gigi's question to Tom, this quote from the Supreme Court was that copyright protection is the engine of free expression. The Supreme Court has, in fact, found that copyright protection has a huge role in stimulating speech, engine of free expression. To Michael's point, I mean, it's just so interesting to hear our lawsuits, the ones that they are, and we're talking about a lot of them here, as stifling innovation because we've sued, in some cases, device manufacturers for different things they've done. And yet for every one lawsuit we filed, there have to be 50, and I'm not exaggerating, by CE companies against other CE companies suing to enjoin them from distributing some technology that you could make the same argument has tremendous, you know, innovative potential, could stimulate a new market, but we never hear from the CE industry anything about, well, no, they shouldn't be suing each other. It's always copyright owners that are stifling innovation while CE companies are just protecting their rights.
No, we don't like any lawsuits. We hate lawyers. we don't like any of that. The Supreme Court also said that the more artistic protection is favored, the more technological innovation may be discouraged. The administration of copyright law is an exercise in managing that trade-off, which I think is what we're all trying to get to here.
But nobody is saying that copyright doesn't promote speech, okay? But no less a copyright maximalist than Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, copyright is only consistent with the First Amendment because of the doctrine of fair use. I mean, that is in the Eldred case. Tom even admitted. So, you know, nothing that Alec just said that copyright is more important from a First Amendment perspective. But there would be no copyright that did not violate the First Amendment without fair use.
All right, we've got time for one more question, if there is any. Anyone have any questions? Another one? Are you nervous what you might create? All right, well, it doesn't look like we have any more questions. I've been asked to mention that in the reception room, if you go out the room here to the right, there's a post-event reception you're all invited to. And I thank my panelists, and I thank you all for coming this afternoon. Thanks much.